This is On Location. I'm Tim Leitner. Today's episode comes to you from Ohio, Colorado, and Alaska. But first, On Location is produced by the NCA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcast, Breaker, iHeartRadio, and Radio Public, among others. So subscribe today on your favorite podcast service and tell all your friends. On today's program, I am pleased to welcome two guests that are known throughout the Child Support Program and who are here to join in a conversation about the legislative proposals that NCIA has initiated. Amy Roerenbeck, co-chair of NCIA's Policy and Government Relations Committee, and Bob Williams, committee member and architect of the legislative proposals, speak about how this came about. They talk about key components, retaining collections, recoupment, enforcement, performance measures, funding for non-custodial parent services, and parenting time orders. Listen as they talk about when the time might be right to bring these proposals forward and what we can expect. It's going to be a great show, so stick around, and we'll be right back. Welcome to another edition of NCIA On Location, coming to you from Ohio, Colorado, and Alaska. I'm Tim Leitner in Anchorage, Alaska, with CGI Technologies and Solutions Incorporated. Today, I'm pleased to welcome two guests that are known throughout the Child Support Program, who are here to join in a conversation about the legislative proposals that NCIA has partnered with and to speak about how this came about. Please welcome Amy Roerenbeck, co-chair of NCIA's Policy and Government Relations Committee, and Bob Williams, committee member and architect of the legislative proposals. So Amy and Bob, welcome to On Location. If you would, please tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves, who you are, where you come from, what role you have with NCIA's PGR committee, anything you'd like to share.
All right. Hi, Tim. Thank you for the kind invitation. My name is Amy Roerenbeck. I'm sitting in Columbus, Ohio today, which is our capital city. And my day job is that I'm the executive director for the Ohio CSEA Directors Association. And my NCIA job is that I serve as co-chair for the Policy and Government Relations Committee. And I believe this is my third year co-chairing this wonderful committee.
Hi, Tim, and thanks very much for the invitation to be on the podcast today. I'm Bob Williams, and I'm in Denver, Colorado. I have a beautiful view of the mountains outside my office windows, which is why I started coming back to the office early after COVID. So I'm Chief Executive Officer of Veritas HHS. We're primarily an outsourcing firm, in that we operate child support agencies in three states, Maryland, North Carolina, and Tennessee, most notably Baltimore, Maryland, Asheville, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee. I've been on the PGR committee for 3 years now, or it's my third year, I think. I've served entirely under Amy's co-chairmanship. And before that, I spent 3 years on the Emerging Issues and Leading Practices Subcommittee of NCIA, where we worked on issues like medical support and child welfare referrals to the program. And before that, I've been very active in NCIA. I've probably gone to 35 or four or more years of conferences, and I've spoken at a number of them. But I think that really kind of sums up my involvement with NCIA up to this point.
It's quite extensive. So I'm gonna ask another extensive kind of question, and kind of just a follow-up question, if you would. And that is, how did you get interested in the child support program, even with your different roles you've held over time? And how long have you been involved in child support, and maybe even some of the other opportunities that you've been involved with NCIA?
I have the distinction of being involved in the program as both a program participant as a child in a child support case. And I won't tell you how long ago that started, but my official child support career began in January 2001. I came into the program as an assistant prosecuting attorney for one of our county child support agencies. And I kept that role there. It was a small county, so I handled everything from paternity all the way up to criminal actions. I was the one woman legal department there. And then I left the county to join our statewide association in 2007. And I just celebrated 16 years there. And I've been their executive director since 2016. And as far as NCIA is concerned, I've been involved with several NCIA committees over the years. I started on one of the PGR subcommittees, I believe with Bob back in the Emerging Issues Leading Practices group. And I've also served many years on the Policy Forum Planning Committee. And was really excited to get to move to the big kids table with the PGR committee 4 or 5 years ago as a member, and then moving into the co-chair position.
So, Tim, as it happens, less than 2 months ago, I marked my 40th anniversary in the child support program. So I've been in the program a long time, and all of that has been at the national level. I got involved in the program in an unusual way. Prior to that, I'd been working on welfare reform types of issues, and the people that I'd worked with in Washington, a couple of them anyway, had moved over to the child support program, which was still quite new, and they were issuing some grant RFPs, and they suggested that I go after some of them. So I applied for a grant to develop the research base on child support for child support guidelines, and then one or more models. So at that point, you have to understand there was only a handful of states, maybe even a half a handful of states, that had child support guidelines. They just really didn't exist. And there was a lot of question about whether judges would follow them, even if they did exist. So that's how I got into child support. I did develop the research base, subsequently developed the income shares model, which is now used by 43 states. And I provided technical assistance along the way to about 40 states in their development of child support guidelines. About a year after that, and as a vehicle for doing more work, I started a company called Policy Studies, Inc. I ran that company for 26 years, and it really became a leader, I think, both in terms of research and demonstration projects in child support, but also in operating child support agencies. In the course of being with that company, I worked on some model projects for voluntary paternity acknowledgement, for example, for interstate enforcement of child support, for review and modifications. Subsequently, that company was sold over my objections in 2012, and so I started Veritas HHS. That makes me a serial entrepreneur, which I hope isn't a crime. It sounds like one. And at Veritas HHS, followed very similar track in terms of really helping to run child support agencies in what we hope is a very effective manner, but also continuing to work on policy issues, most notably the impact of the Affordable Care Act on medical support. Amy and I did a great workshop on that in Ohio, maybe 2014, something like that. And then also worked on foster care issues to some extent, and especially on one that we'll be talking about today, recoupment of TANF payments. So that's kind of my history. It's kind of long, but I've been around for a while.
And Bob, we're glad that you have. And really, congratulations to both of you for your contributions to the child support program. It's a long list and a lot of involvement, a lot of sweat and tears, I'm sure. But thank you for, you know, you almost want to say thank you for your service, but truly, it's much, much appreciated. And I'm honored to be sitting in your likes and around the virtual table today with you. So let me ask this, Amy, if you could tell us a little bit about our conversation today and why we're here. How did it come up? When did it come up? Who's involved? Just give us a little bit idea about these legislative proposals that now some, maybe not everybody yet, is talking about, but it's getting around.
So as you just alluded to, Tim, when you have someone like Bob who has the expertise and experience that he has, if he stops you somewhere and says, I think I want to talk to you about something, I've got some ideas, then you say, okay, I've dropped everything, let's hear it. And that's how this particular conversation got started. I think at Policy Forum in 2022, which seems like kind of a lifetime ago, but Bob approached us with an idea that, you know, in the child support program, a lot of what we do is reactive. We have to play defense a lot against legislation and rule changes. You know, we're pivoting constantly because of changes going on, and we don't really get a chance to really stop and think about ways that we can be proactive in making positive changes to our program. And it's been a while since there's been significant child support legislation at the national level that would be far reaching to kind of look at the things that this particular legislative proposal looks at. So that's kind of how this started. At the time, Diane Potts and I were serving as co-chairs for PGR, and we took this kind of as a wonderful opportunity to really take some time and dig in on the things that we're going to talk about today and engage and really get interest from the PGR members to see what does it look like as far as some of the areas that Bob has identified and others have identified as far as areas of improvement or things where we would just really like to see the program move forward. So the work was started at that point in time in PGR. We started some subgroups to handle some of the major topics and kind of unpack that wish list of improvements, kind of put those into some overarching categories, and then really start to coalesce around some recommendations that PGR wanted to take to the NCIA board to get some feedback on, you know, where do we want to go? Did they feel like we were going in the right direction? Do we feel like we've got support to kind of tackle some of these big changes? And the work on this continues today.
Great. So from what I'm hearing, what I'm understanding is that there's a tremendous interest from the NCIA PGR committee. How many work groups were formed and what happened with the starting list?
So I'm sure the starting list might be in a frame somewhere, maybe hanging in Bob's office, but we took the list and we set up subgroups. I think in late March 2022, we really kind of got moving on this when we got back from Policy Forum. And we looked at basically five programmatic areas. So we looked at funding, we looked at pass-through and ending retained collections. We looked at revising performance standards, improvements that could be made around intergovernmental case processing, and the expansion of some of our enforcement remedies. So we divided into, we had PGR members on each one of those subgroups. And we worked on this throughout 2022, and I feel like into 2023, which sounds weird because we're still in 2023. But again, I feel like that those work groups were so long ago. But the draft was presented to the NCIA board, I believe at the Policy Forum this year. So it had been around in February 2023 to get feedback on the direction, some of the initial recommendations, just to kind of make sure they felt like PGR was on track to take these forward. Had some great support from the board. And then we've been working behind the scenes just to get things ready to go when the time comes to kind of deliver this, you know, to start to get some support with Congress.
Yeah, lots of work, lots of behind the scenes, off camera, if you will, lots going on. So Bob, let me ask you about retaining collections and how this kind of factors into all this.
Well, retained collections, if we include both retained collections and recoupments, and I'll get back to that in a minute in terms of definitions, was really one of the most significant of the recommendations that we came up with. Retained, in terms of semantics, this is the way I use the terminology. Retained collections really, to me, refers to withholding child support from current TANF recipients over and above the $100 or $200 disregards that about half the states have. It's kind of akin to counting child support as income, only we're doing a service to the recipients by not passing it through to them so that they then have to declare it and then have a subsequent grant reduced because they have this child support as income. So that to me is retained collection. And we've You talked about advocating the elimination of retained collections for current TANF recipients, primarily because there's evidence from Colorado that doing so would improve the payment rate for child support. And of course, the TANF program, it's temporary assistance. People go off TANF. You want to get that stream of child support coming. And Colorado is the only state that's eliminated retained collections for current TANF recipients because one of the reasons is money, because if you go beyond the $100, $200 disregard and you pass through the rest to TANF recipients, then you have to pay the federal share back to the federal government. Colorado does that painfully, I think. And so Colorado did a study on this and they found that they got 10% more payments from the non-custodial payments in TANF cases and 39% more dollars from those payments from former TANF non-custodial parents. And so that provides some evidence that, you know, they're more willing to make the payments to non-custodial parents if they know it's going to the family and not to the government. So that plus the fact, there's, I think, a couple of other factors, which is in many states now, a large proportion of the TANF recipients are caretaker parents, not the actual parents themselves. And so when you get involved with that type of situation, it gets quite complicated in terms of child support. In addition to that, TANF program in many states has really shrunk. I was really shocked when in one of our meetings, Aaron Frisch, who's 40 director of Michigan and the current NCIA president, said they only had 3,000 TANF recipients, TANF families in Michigan. That's just a very small number. So that's why I think there's a lot of support now, even though it wasn't part of the original recommendations coming out of the work group, but the board made it clear that they wanted to recommend just ending retained collections altogether. I think recoupments are another story. Recoupments are what I deem to be what we do for former TANF recipients when we retain child support in order to repay TANF benefits that they had received while they were on TANF. So this to me is one of the most significant flaws that we have in the current child support program for a whole variety of reasons. And I think it's complicated the program. It's adversely affected our relationship with parents, increased our systems costs. But most importantly, it's really, I think, undermined the self-sufficiency of former TANF recipients just at the very time that you want them to be self-sufficient. They've gone off TANF, they're now self-sufficient. Now you're taking money out of that family in order to repay TANF benefits. So that's kind of, it was really coming back and taking a look at that and really making that, I think, one of the most significant recommendations that came out of the first the work group and then the whole committee and the board that I think is one of the most significant things that's part of the proposed package.
Yeah, and I've got to ask. I think you had shared recently when we were talking about this podcast about some recent or a recent book that you were reading, and some information on a Leslie King Jr. And I just thought that was fascinating what you were sharing, and I'd kind of like you to share that with our listeners today.
Well, then we're going to go back a little bit in time in history. I was alive and working back then, but more on the welfare reform side. So I remember some of this pretty well. We're going back to 1975 when Title 4D was added to the Social Security Act. Primary impetus for that was a recovery mission. And it came from Senator Russell Long of Louisiana. And his background, the AFDC roles, to families with dependent children, the precursor to TANF, those roles were, I think it would be safe to say, exploding. A large part of the reason for that was that the non-marital birth rate was going up geometrically. The non-marital birth rate before 1975 had almost tripled over 15 years from 1960 to 1975. It was all the way up to exceeded 15% non-marital birth rate. Now, we would be pretty excited to see that now that our rate is 40%. But back then, it was very alarming. And AFDC was a program that had been designed to help widows and orphans, not so much unmarried parents. And so Senator Russell Long from Louisiana wanted to develop the 4D program basically to help recover some of those AFDC payments and to reduce the costs of the AFDC program. And so he worked for several years to develop the Title 4D and get it through Congress. So then that legislation was signed by Gerald Ford Jr., the president of the United States. I never thought much of that until I just happened to read a biography of him a few months ago. And I found in reading the biography that he had his own motivation for signing that bill. It had nothing to do with recovery. It had everything to do with family support. And why was that true? And this was the mind-blowing part that you alluded to. Gerald Ford Jr. was not born Gerald Ford Jr. He was born Leslie King Jr. And he was born in Omaha. And Leslie King Sr., it turned out, was a wife abuser. And after a few months of dealing with the situation, Leslie King Jr.'s mother then decided to leave Omaha and move back to family in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where Gerald Ford Jr. grew up. In the meantime, Leslie King Sr., he moved on to Wyoming, bought himself a nice ranch up by Riverton. He was a man of some means, apparently. And he owed child support to Gerald Ford's mother, which he never paid. In other words, he was your classic deadbeat dad. She waited and she waited. And finally, when Gerald Ford Jr. was in high school, she sued for child support. She was awarded $5,500. He still didn't pay. She got an attorney finally and got him to settle for $4,000. The attorney's fee was about a third of the $4,000. So she ended up with basically half of what she was owed. By that time, Gerald Ford Jr. was in Michigan, University of Michigan, I mean, and scraping by, having a hard time supporting himself through college. So she sent the check to him, and he said, "Mom, you know, this money's for you," and he sent it right back. So that made a lasting impression on him. The way he became Gerald Ford Jr., of course, was that after several years of living in Grand Rapids, she married Gerald Ford Sr. He became the surrogate father to Gerald Ford Jr. Through this youth, there was confusion about his name, so they called him Jr. And it wasn't until he was in high school that he adopted his surrogate father's name. Gerald Ford Sr. never adopted Gerald Ford Jr. And maybe never officially gave him his name, but he was a great father, and he acted as the real father to Gerald Ford Jr. So when Gerald Ford Jr. Signed that bill, he had earlier introduced his own child support legislation. I've never been able to research it, but I'm sure that it was more oriented toward the family support mission of child support. So child support started with kind of a double mission that sometimes was in conflict between recovery and family support. And we still have that double mission with us today, but very, very different. The recovery part of the mission didn't work as well as Senator Russell Long hoped. He never got nearly the money that he wanted to get out of the Title 4D program. And in the meantime, when you move on to like 1984, the Child Support Enforcement Amendments of 84, Family Support Act of 88, and then ultimately PAWORA, because of the social demand for better child support enforcement across everyone, the family support mission became more and more dominant within the program. But still, in 1996, when welfare reform was enacted, 24% of the collections went to recovery to pay back TANF benefits, either for current or former TANF, well, then it was AFTC benefits. But then what happened in the intervening 27 years is that the mission shifted dramatically. And it wasn't because toward family support, and it wasn't because of anything the child support program did. It's because between time of welfare reform and now, the number of cases receiving TANF, the number of families declined by 80%. And in the meantime, the child support program became much stronger through all the tools we got through welfare reform and started collecting a lot more money for non-welfare recipients. And as a result, as we get out to 2022, the collections to repay government for TANF benefits amounts to less than 4% now of our total collections. In other words, the mission has become 96% family support and 4% recovery. And it's because of that shift in mission and the fact that the recoupments jeopardize, I think, self-sufficiency as well as greatly complicate the program and cause a lot of unnecessary expense, that we're all looking at the prospect here of doing away with that part of our mission, doing away with the recovery mission almost altogether by doing away with recoupments and retained collections.
Can I add one more thing too,
to please.
Bob's already amazing explanation of why this is something worthy of discussing? I think that the other thing that kind of brought this more into the public eye recently was the tax offset issue with regard to the stimulus checks. Because I know that, you know, when we were talking about recouping funds that were owed, you know, at a time when they were looking to move money out into families through the stimulus, that first round of stimulus checks, you know, many states were looking at whether or not they could change quickly. I don't think many of them were able to change their processes quickly. And that money then came back to us, us being the program, us being a program under Title 4D to repay those funds. And I think that that was something at a time when they really wanted to move money out to families that were struggling due to job loss. It did not necessarily shine a really positive light on what our program was trying to do. Subsequent stimulus payments were exempted as we went forward, but I think that was yet another reason why this issue is still one that is being discussed and really looking at, you know, is this something that we need to continue down this road of cost recovery?
Yeah, that's a point we'll take, and thank you for sharing that. That's extremely timely.
Tim, there may be one other point that's key here. I'm sorry to interrupt, and that is, unlike retained collections with recoupments, states have had the option since 2005 under DRA 2005 to go ahead and stop recoupments with no financial penalty. Unlike retained collections, they don't have to pay back the federal government for the federal share of that. So the question arises, why haven't states done that? And before 2023, zero states had done that, had availed themselves of that option. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is that people just didn't know about that option. They kind of forgot about it after 2005. And recoupments have been so much part of the woodwork of the program since 1975. People just kind of accepted that. I think the second reason, though, the more salient reason, is money. Because the revenue from retained collections and recoupments has been a significant factor in most states in funding the 4D program, and in other states where they don't use it to fund the 4D program, to fund other significant functions of government. So before 2023, no state had adopted that option. But now states are really discussing it, taking a hard look at it. New Mexico earlier this year became the first state to stop collecting recoupments. Wyoming is ready to pull the trigger. 2024, California is scheduled to drop TANF recoupments, and Illinois, we think, as well. And there are probably other states out there that I don't know of. So there's just a lot of ferment around this issue right now. And I think there's a lot of progress being made while we wait for possible federal legislation.
Yeah, thank you. So, Amy, enforcement has been a strength in the child support program for so many program localities. Can you tell us about this and why look to do changes now?
I think our program has always had a strong commitment to ensure the reliable payment of support to children and families. That mission has changed over the years as far as how are we doing that? Are we looking to, now really a focus on ability to pay, really looking at setting orders based on current ability to pay. But we're always looking for new practices, new initiatives, and best practices from states that we could look to kind of deploy nationwide. Because I think we are a program always looking at continuous improvements. We've got changing economy right now. We've got a changing workforce. We've got a lot more people that are working in the gig economy. We have people that are getting paid in ways that we didn't even think about how they would get paid. So, when we think about not only setting orders, but if the time comes that we need to enforce those orders, are there some things that we could do to improve the program? I think with this legislative proposal, we're looking at creating consistency because some states have some enforcement measures in place that have proven to be successful that other jurisdictions do not. So if we could look at trying to kind of level that across the states and make those things available, we want to do that because we want to look again at continuous improvement in the collection of child support. That's one of the most important things that we do. Some examples of what we were looking at in this legislative proposal. One is something that we just were talking about. We had a Midwest urban jurisdiction meeting in Chicago for Region 5 a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about a new hire. And we were talking about whether or not your state would require employers to report independent contractors. My state, Ohio, we do require that. We average about 16,500 independent contractor reports each year. I don't even think that's close to the amount of independent contractors we may have, but we do have a statute in place and we do have a mechanism to get that reported. Not every state has that. So looking to make sure that's a practice that we've got going on in every state so that employers would have to report not only their regular new hires, but also independent contractors. Another thing that I know we've talked about in PGR over the years is requiring the Bureau of Prisons to honor an income withholding order without the consent of the incarcerated parent. The Bureau of Prisons at the federal level says that requires a law change. So we think that that is a positive change that could be made. I know in my state, if a parent is incarcerated in our state prison system, they do not have to give consent to have their prison wages intercepted for payment of child support. But if it is a federal inmate, they do. So we want to make sure that, we can pursue a change there because we really think that until Bureau of Prisons would be able to make that change, then we're going to have parents that just say, I'm going to opt out of paying child support. We're talking about under this proposal some data match expansions. That includes central databases in states that could be checked by probate administrators, executors, and attorneys when we've got probate matters going on. State prisons for states that don't have coordination through interfaces between child support and the prison system, making sure that that is available. We have one in my state, and it's been very, very helpful, but not every state has that. And then, as we think about the ways that we can locate people, when we think about locate being one of the major functions that we have in the child support program, we think about kind of the old school ways of finding people. And there's so many new ways and avenues to try to locate people now that maybe don't necessarily want to be found. So really looking at expanding data matching with cell phone companies, cable companies, and utilities to kind of just open up more avenues for us to be able to locate people and be able to enforce those orders. I know we also talked about in this legislative proposal some federal mandates, including support for the tribal bill, which would be probably a whole separate podcast. And I think you probably got to talk to Tom Joseph about that a little bit, but really supporting the tribal bill. It has just recently been reintroduced by Senators Thune and Wyden for tribal enforcement and also the IRS contractor piece that comes with it. Passport revocation to require a process for revoking passports would be very helpful. Lump sum employer matches, fraudulent tax returns to prohibit the IRS from holding the states liable for those. And we had so many fraudulent tax returns that happened during the pandemic. And, you know, that can have some catastrophic effects when you go to try to process those and pull money back. You know, looking at full faith and credit for liens, and looking at working more with the Department of Justice and the U.S. Marshals to assist in location and apprehension of obligors if they happen to leave your jurisdiction. A couple of other quick things under kind of the general enforcement header would be state mandates. Again, some states have these, some states don't. One would be insurance claims to mandate states to enact laws requiring insurance companies to report pending insurance claims. I know in Ohio, we're part of the Child Support Lien Network. There's 28 states in the District of Columbia that are part of that to kind of work on doing those lump sums over to the insurance companies, but not every state has that. Gambling, to mandate laws requiring reporting and intercept of gambling proceeds, including sports betting. I know that's a big thing in my state. And I think as sports betting is kind of becoming more common state to state, you know, we may see more states getting on board with that, but really looking to make sure we have that available in the states that have it. Mandating electronic registries of professional licenses, online registries for real property, vehicles, and other property, and then motor vehicle registration. So really just thinking about what are those ways that we would be able to find information, be able to locate assets, be able to locate parties, what can we do to really help ourselves be more efficient at being able to collect child support and enforce those orders.
That's quite a hefty list.
It's quite a list, yes.
So, Bob, let's talk about performance measures. And I've got a feeling this is kind of near and dear to your heart or your passion. Can you tell us about what are performance measures and kind of give us a background and the context for the legislative proposals that are being suggested?
Yeah, Tim, I think that our performance measures, as many people know, came from the Child Support Performance and Incentives Act of 1998, called CESPA. And a lot of ways you could think of those as being a beta test of performance measures because there weren't any before that. But for 25 years now, we've been living with that beta test. And so partly, you can say that the program has outrun those performance measures, right? Because we've improved our performance so much in so many areas. My favorite example of this really is cases under order. Back in 2000, the first year when these took effect, there were five states below the minimum level of incentives for cases under order. In other words, their cases under order, believe it or not, were below 50%. Now there's only six states below the maximum level of incentives for cases under order, which is 80%. So that's a good example where, it's obvious that we really need to adjust the range to make that more effective. And the other thing is we just learned a lot about these performance incentives living with them for 25 years. So it's time to kind of make them work for us a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, so Bob, if you would lay it on us, what changes are being proposed for performance measures? And can you share some of the analysis?
Well, this is worth a web talk by itself, but I think let me do it briefly, okay, and see if I can kind of give people a taste of what there is. I mean, I think the first is with PEP, and PEP, I think our major goal was to take the irrationality out of PEP, because really now, how can you have PEP rates over 100%? How can you be establishing paternity for more kids than you have needing to have paternity established? Turns out there's two reasons for that, one that's well known and one that's not, and both of which we're trying to correct. One is that we have what what's called the prior year base year problem, which is that PEP is based on the number of kids needing paternity established the prior year, not this year. Well, we're fixing that, we hope, by saying this year. The other one is not well known, and that is that states, when they report the paternities that are established, it's not a snapshot at the end of the year, the number of paternities established. Any paternity is established for any case open during the year, and it means it turns out that there are a lot of paternity cases that open and close during the year. So as a result, you get a numerator that's higher than your denominator, and that's why you can get PEP rates over 100%. So we would get rid of that by making sure that the denominator also reflects paternity cases that are open and closed during the course of the year. There's a recommendation that's still part of the proposed legislation also to move from two PEP versions, 4D PEP and statewide, just to 4D. But there's a lot of pushback to that, I think, for good reason. And I think there's good possibility that we won't go forward with that part of the recommendation. In terms of the other performance standards, cases with orders, just move the range from 50 to 80 to 75 to 95. A case, current support, just move the range, bottom of the range, up from 40 to 50. Then arrears is the other measure that people have been dissatisfied with because, as you know, right now, if you collect 1 cent on a case, it counts as a collection of arrears against the case. And so that case goes into your good category. Instead, there's a desire to come up with a different approach that looks at the proportion of arrears that gets collected. And so Jim Fleming was really the architect of, I would say, all the performance measure proposals here, but he came up with, I thought, a very ingenious approach, which is to look at your arrears that accrue during the course of a year. You look at your current support that's due in the course of a year. You collect, let's say, 70% of that as current support, and then the other 30% becomes arrears. So then you compare that with how many total arrears you've collected, both from current year cases and past year cases. And if you collect less than the new amount of arrears that you have, then your backlog is building. And if you collect more than the new arrears that have accrued, your backlog is diminishing. And that's going to be the basis for that performance standard if it's adopted. For cost effectiveness, just up the range by a dollar. But let me say something about the performance measures are a critical piece of legislative package, not just because of updating them, which is very important in and of itself, but NCIA is trying to kind of cut a deal with Congress here, is saying, if you adopt our other recommendations, which will require funding, we're recommending a funding mechanism, which is to triple the incentive pool. In other words, to really further leverage the performance based structure of this program. And we're willing as a community to raise the bar on performance measures if Congress is willing to raise the funding of the program and allow us to improve the services that we provide.
So Amy, let's add to this discussion. Can you tell us about funding for non-custodial parent services? And does this play a part? And what kind of services are you talking about?
I think anybody that spends any time in the child support program knows that we have very limited funding streams, especially when you compare us to the other health and human service programs. So I think we have to be very creative and very thoughtful when we look at what opportunities exist to try to expand program funds. A lot of that is through the use of federal financial participation, so FFP. So there's been a lot of momentum over the years to fund more non-custodial parent, when we say NCP, non-custodial parent services, in an effort to serve the whole family. And so I think a great place to start, which we talk about in this legislative proposal, is to fund child support-led employment services for underemployed and unemployed non-custodial parents. And then also to build upon the successes that states have had, states like Texas, with engaging parents with parenting time orders. You know, with both the child support-led employment services and the parenting time, those both kind of came from grant programs years ago through the Parenting Time Opportunities for Children, kind of build off of that on the parenting time, being able to establish parenting time orders in certain circumstances. And then the Child Support Employment Demonstration Acts, like CSPED, through the 1115 grants. So really kind of building upon those. So, you know, when we're talking about I want to make sure I kind of add in, when we're talking about parenting time orders, what we were looking at with that in the legislative proposal is allowing things like case management, mediation services, and assistance in developing agreed orders, with a huge caveat saying that any of these activities would have to be accompanied by suitable safeguards to protect and prevent domestic violence. Because I think we want to make sure, that we're not putting anybody into a dangerous situation. So we would need to have training, screening, and ongoing assessment on that with this kind of opening up FFP for parenting time orders. I do want to note, too, that it would not include activities related to enforcing that parenting time order. So again, trying to get people, engage them at the beginning of the case. We know there's plenty of statistics about the involvement of parents and what that means for the success of their children. And so really engaging people at the beginning with, again, those domestic violence safeguards in place.
You know, Amy, I think those of us that have been involved or listened to different leaders in NCIA talk for a number of years, that word engagement has been pretty key. And that sounds exactly what you're talking about here, is engaging participants, engaging the family, and not just for increased collections, but for the benefit of the child and in the family unit. So lots going on there. So Bob and Amy, I think that timing might be extremely important or even critical. I'm thinking about how Congress has provided bipartisan support for the child support program for many, many years. And I expect that you might think that this Congress might be a little different. What are your observations, and what would be the right time to start making congressional discussions for this proposal?
I'll jump in and then turn it over to Bob. I think calling it a little different might be an understatement. There's obviously a lot going on right now, and we are watching how things unfold. And really kind of using this time right now as an opportunity to dig in on some further work on the legislative proposal and to do some fine tuning. We want to go through an equity analysis of the proposal. We want to be able to share the proposal with a broader audience to get feedback and really work to garner support for it before we move ahead with any type of congressional outreach. From my own state legislative experience, I know the value in taking your time, doing your homework, spending time on background research, knowing the players, lining up your champions, and really being ready to go. Because when you talk about a package that is this large and cohesive, because I don't think that all of these things are meant to kind of play off each other. Bob was talking about specifically to the performance measurements. You know, it does have to be performance measurements with the funding. Like, there's things that have to go together when we talk about these. So really being able to kind of paint the picture when we get to that point of how these things work together and why it's important that you can't start pulling out the pieces that you like and you don't like, so that we have a cohesive message for, you know, legislators that want to be at the 100,000 foot level and legislators and staffers who want to get in the weeds. So really having that. And Bob has a great summary document he's put together, kind of an executive summary that goes through this, because, I mean, we've only kind of just touched the tip of the iceberg on a lot of these things today. But, you know, really having, for those people that want to dig in, you know, here's the information so you can dig in. But for those people who are like, I don't want to get in the weeds, just talk to me about what this means, to be able to have that message too at a higher level. So I do think, you know, despite the kind of the chaos that's been going on at the national level, in Congress right now, and obviously we're coming up on another deadline for, potential government shutdown, we know they've got some priorities that they've got to address right now. That does give us a little bit of time to really make sure that this is going to be ready to deliver as a final product when the time comes.
Tim, I would only add, I don't think any of us expected this to be a quick process. And right now, it seems like nothing's going on, but that's not true. We're soliciting feedback from a lot of key groups, especially National Child Support Directors Association, but also American Public Human Services Association and other players, that it's very important to get their input. Might or might not get through that process in time to try to get legislation introduced with this Congress. But I think if we don't, I think if the opportunity arises, we will. But I think that if the opportunity doesn't arise, that it's not a serious drawback to us. We'll just wait for the next legislative session and see what kind of opportunities arise then.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So, Amy and Bob, with all that's been said today, has anything been left out, or is there anything to add or to stress as we wrap up our conversation?
Well, I would just add one thing, and that is that with the decline in the TANF program, precipitous decline, I might add, and the growth in the child support program now distributes more than four times as much to families as the TANF program does in benefits. So I think we all need to recognize what a critical role the child support plays in this country's safety net for single parent families. And so a lot of the motivation for this legislative package is to build on the family support mission of the program as it has evolved over the almost 50 years now, and make this a program that serves our families even better than it has in the past.
Well, we want to thank our guests today, Amy Rorenbeck and Bob Williams, for spending time with us and sharing the legislative proposals that NCS Policy and Government Relations Committee has taken the lead on and others have partnered with to show collaborative agreement and change is warranted. I'm sure that there will be more to come as time continues to move forward and as you look forward at the right time. We want to thank our listeners for joining us today and, as always, for listening to another episode. I'm Tim Leitner, and this has been On Location. On Location is available on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. We have a lot of great episodes on the way, so be sure to subscribe and listen to all of our previous episodes as well. We also appreciate your ratings, your feedback, your comments, and your suggestions. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. On Location is a production of the NCA Communications Committee with special production assistance from Joe Mamlin and me. Thanks again for joining me. I'm Tim Leitner, and this has been On Location.